We are talking with Joe Connison. He is a journalist and author. He writes a column for the weekly New York Observer newspaper and is a regular contributor to Salon.com. He is the author of several books, including The Hunting of the President, The 10-Year Campaign to Destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton, which he co-authored with Gene Lyons. He also has written Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth, and his new book, The Raw Deal, How the Bush Republicans Plan to Destroy Social Security and the Legacy of the New Deal. Joe, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
If we could begin, tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, The Raw Deal?
Well, I looked at what the president said would be the highest priority of his second term last spring, and decided that this was an appropriate topic for a short, pithy book, how the Republicans had decided to do this, why they wanted to basically phase out the Social Security system, and an examination of the means by which they were doing this, which includes who was behind it, how much money they were spending, and what kind of propaganda techniques they were using to sell this or to attempt to sell it. And a new publisher, Polypoint Press, approached me. They wanted to do a book about this, and we did it. And it's a short, pithy book with no math in it, by the way. People worry that if you're going to discuss Social Security, there's going to be a great deal of math. There's very little numbers crunching in this book, although I do discuss some of the numbers issues at the end of the book.
So it appears right at this point in time, though, that the push for privatization of Social Security has kind of died out. Do you believe it's going to get a second wind?
I would say it's stalled, definitely. But this is a goal that the right has been pursuing at different levels for at least 40 years, since the Barry Goldwater campaign in 1964, and it's come and gone in waves and cycles. This particular wave is the most intense ever in the 70-year history of the system. It began as soon as the president was elected or took office in 2001, when he appointed a commission called the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, which was staffed solely with people who supported privatization. In other words, to be on the President's Commission, you had to, in advance, agree with him that the system needed to be privatized in some way. And the actual staff, the working staff of the commission, all came from the Cato Institute, which you may know is a right-wing think tank in Washington, funded by corporations, that is for the most radical type of privatization. Those people came over and worked for the White House on this commission. What they discovered in this first phase of the president's attempt was that the math didn't work, and so they couldn't come up with a plan after 9 months that they were willing to propose as their own. Meanwhile, the stock market was tanking. This is the end of 2001. The Enron scandal was bursting open, and it no longer seemed like a brilliant idea to turn everybody's retirement security over to the private sector. So it went away for a while then. And I think people probably assumed it was dead then, too. But it wasn't. 2 years later, after the president was reelected and they maintained control of both houses of Congress, immediately last year, first thing they leaked about their priorities for the second term was this was the top priority. And it's been something the president has wanted to do for close to 30 years, according to his own record. So the fact that they're running into difficulties now because of the hurricanes and the war and the president's, you know, plunging popularity, to me means that it's on the back burner for now, but it still remains a fundamental goal of the conservative movement.
And do you believe that all the Republicans are behind this? I notice in your subtitle you use the term Bush Republicans.
Bush Republicans. Yeah. Well, in that sense, the Bush Republicans are, in a way, not just the supporters of this president, but a subset of the most radical Republicans, the Karl Roves, the Grover Norquists, who your listeners may have heard of, the ideologues of the party who really want to accomplish the goals that were set forth in the Goldwater campaign by the most radical supporters of Ronald Reagan when he was elected president. These are all plans deferred over time, but now that they believe they have complete power in Washington, I think they've hoped that they could enact, you know, their maximum program. Social Security is the toughest thing, but it's also the biggest prize. It's the toughest because it's popular, it's successful. there's really no reason to change it in the ways that they want to. In fact, what they want to do would be very destructive to it. At the same time, it is a prize that is worth, estimated close to $1 trillion over the coming decades in just fees and other charges alone to the banking and insurance industry if they got to privatize it in the stock market. And it is a huge ideological prize. It is the bulwark of the New Deal. And if they take it down, I think they would see that as probably the biggest ideological victory that the conservative movement could have.
Maybe briefly you can give us a little history about the beginnings of it. I understand there was resistance to Social Security from right off the bat.
Oh, sure. The Republican Party in the 1930s was completely opposed to Social Security, as was the business community. In fact, many of the same organizations that exist now that are fighting for this privatization plan of the president's were the opponents of FDR back then. The National Association of Manufacturers is one. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is another one. Nowadays, they disguise themselves under other rubrics. They put up a front group that is called the Coalition to Modernize and Protect America's Social Security, because they always, as you may know, they say the opposite of what it is they actually intend to do. And so they create a coalition like that that serves as a front. Back in Roosevelt's day, they were much more out front. They were, you could tell who was doing what. And he defeated them resoundingly. And basically, they were not heard from again for, 30 years until the 60s when Goldwater turned up and said that he thought it was time to get rid of Social Security.
Talk about some more of the groups, the organizations that were put together specifically for this issue. I believe one of the terms is AstroTurf.
Yes. AstroTurf means, as you might expect, fake grassroots. And in the conservative movement, this is a perennial tactic now. It doesn't just apply to Social Security, although they've certainly used it quite heavily there. And it means putting together some type of constituency organization that is designed to look like it represents diverse members of the community rather than just, a few wealthy businessmen. So there would be a black or African-American organization. In this case, a case I describe in the book that's actually very funny, it's a group called Project 21, which supposedly represents black conservatives. And of course, there are some black conservatives, and by every right. But one day, black conservative was supposed to turn up on a C-SPAN program, and his car broke down. And so he called the office of Project 21 and said, somebody else has to go. And the black host of the C-SPAN program, this is early in the morning, is kind of shocked when in walks a white guy to represent the black conservative organization. And he blurts out on the air, wait a minute, black, I'm African-American conservatives, but you're white. And it turned out that Project 21 is actually a subsidiary of a white-controlled right-wing group in Washington and is run on a day-to-day basis by a white man. And they would go out and propagandize on behalf of Social Security privatization in the black community, but more importantly, to make it seem as if there was broad-based support for this kind of thing. Now, there's another one, United Seniors Association. This was intended to be the kind of doppelganger or alternative to the AARP, American Association of Retired Persons, which is a large real organization of upwards of 30 million members. United Seniors, nobody knows how many members they really have, but it's funded by the drug companies and other corporations to represent the interests of senior citizens. And they have a women's organization, whose name escapes me at the moment, but this is another thing set up by a woman who had worked at the Cato Institute and had worked as a corporate lobbyist for an oil company in Washington, and who had made appearances with the president to promote Social Security privatization last spring. These are all tactical creations that are supposed to convince the public that there is a broad-based constituency for this. And so, therefore, it would be okay to be for it yourself, because people just like you have this have accepted this idea.
And these groups with their front people are trotted out before the media and at, let's say, press conferences.
Oh, sure. And they have websites. You can go on the web and find these organizations. When the president went on his speaking tour about Social Security last spring, which he managed to convince more and more people that he was wrong as he went along, but nevertheless, they would have these events. And these groups, or the people who ran these alleged groups, would bring a few like-minded people into these events for the president so that they would make sure there was nobody there who didn't agree. The one thing, these folks don't like debate very much. This is why he had to have a commission that had people who all agreed with him. Problem was, in that case, it turned out they couldn't make the math work and they couldn't agree among themselves over what to do. And they ended up with three supposed plans that were all different, and none of them worked. And it was kind of buried for a while. But and, you know, it's interesting to note that the president himself has never come forward with a bill. He has yet to put forward a Social Security privatization, or as they like to say, reform bill of his own. He has asked people on the Hill to come up with their various bills, and he would see which ones he liked. He hasn't wanted to attach his name to it, and I think for very good reason. There is not a way to make this work that does not do grave, grave damage to people who will depend on this system.
Talk a little bit more about the think tanks that are backing this. You mentioned the Cato Institute. What other think tanks have been involved?
Well, historically, there are really, I mean, as you probably know, there are now dozens of conservative think tanks, or possibly scores or hundreds. But going back to the early 80s, there were really two that focused on this particular issue. One was the Cato Institute. The other is the Heritage Foundation, which is probably the largest, most famous, and most widely known of these conservative think tanks. Cato and Heritage worked together, and what they did was set forth a paper, a working paper on how to get Social Security privatized, in which the authors of this paper formulated what they called a Leninist, as in Vladimir Lenin of the Russian Revolution, a Leninist strategy. And I'm not sure why they called it that, except that it was somewhat devious. They wanted to put together these kinds of grassroots groups and fund them with money from Wall Street. In other words, the idea was, we have the ideological passion, and we have some of the sort of conservative shock troops. We need money to do this. Where are we going to get the money? We're going to go to the banks, insurance companies, stock brokerages, and others who would benefit from diverting this revenue stream from the public sector to the private sector and create this grand coalition to make this change. And they describe in great detail how you convince various segments of the population to support this. It's a very interesting paper. I quote it at some length in the book, and that is where these ideas were first generated. Now, at the time that they wrote this paper, in I think it was 1980, they believed that they could create this coalition in time to push this through during the Reagan administration. The problem was that Reagan faced a Democratic House of Representatives, and at certain points during his administration, a Democratic Senate as well. And they were just not going to countenance this. There was no way that Tip O'Neill, who was then the Speaker of the House, was going to permit Social Security to be privatized. President Reagan, who was a very savvy politician, I think realized that right away. And the truth is that Social Security actually did have fiscal problems at that time. They needed to solve them, and they did. President Reagan appointed Alan Greenspan, chairman of a commission, a real bipartisan commission, to look into what should be done for Social Security. They created these trust funds and raised the taxes a little bit and changed the benefit structure a bit and made the system solvent for another at least 70 years. So that was a successful bipartisan agreement that President Reagan oversaw. So in a way, he was much less radical than Bush. He was more conservative in the traditional sense of keeping systems going that work and that serve the public and reforming them as necessary. The conservatives who had such high hopes for aspects of the Reagan administration for their own ideological purposes found that they were frustrated by that. But they didn't go away. They waited, and they came back when Bush was president.
You have to imagine that having, you know, your hopes there with Reagan for him to fix the system, so to speak, and then having him actually, you know, repair it and make it better must have been pulling their hair out.
They were upset about that. They were very upset. And I guess it was a sign of his political strength that they made so little noise about it at the time. And I think they realized that there was no way to overcome the opposition in the House to these kinds of plans. I mean, they were somewhat realistic about it. But they saw themselves as laying the groundwork for change in the future. I mean, this is one of the things that distinguishes the modern conservative movement is they are very determined, they have a long-range perspective, they don't give up. So the notion that because right now they can't move Social Security in the Senate, which is really the obstacle now, they could certainly pass a bill in the House anytime they wanted to, but the House doesn't want to do it if the Senate won't. The fact that the Senate is now a roadblock to this for political reasons does not at all mean that they've given up on this.
Talk about some of the corporations, the companies that would directly benefit from this.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about $1 trillion in fees and other charges that would go to the providers of privatized Social Security accounts over a period of decades, it's almost everybody in the financial industry, because we now have deregulated the industry to such an extent that ultimately almost anybody could offer these services. Now, the president has said at the outset that we would start with people's choices being somewhat limited. I mean, they've talked out of both sides of their mouth on this. So on the one hand, they say, well, you'll be able to control it all yourself. On the other hand, actually, the choices would be quite limited at the beginning to some mutual funds. And so it would be interesting to see whose mutual funds get this money at the beginning and how they were selected. Ultimately, I think the goal is to have it be wide open and have people allowed to make any kind of investment with this money that they could be enticed into making. The object lesson for that is in Great Britain, where 20 years ago, the Thatcher government succeeded in pushing through a wholesale privatization of their Social Security system, and it led to incredible losses through fraud. People lost tremendous amounts of money, their savings, and ended up destitute because they had been tricked, basically, into buying things that were worthless. And now the British are trying to figure out how to get back to a system that's more like ours. If you ask them, you know, what kind of Social Security system they would like to have, conservative businessmen over there will tell you, well, we'd be better off if it was like yours. Meanwhile, over here, there are people who will still tell you, oh, we should make it like the British system, because they know that most people don't understand what happened over there. So the financial industry overall would benefit tremendously, and not just from fees. Obviously, if you have trillions of dollars moving into the stock market and other securities, it drives the prices up. You know, this would be the largest sudden inflow of capital into the financial, into the equity system, stock markets and other markets that we had ever seen. And so with more money chasing the securities, the prices would go through the roof. And don't think that isn't a motivation for this as well.
Talk about the sales techniques that they were using lately to push the whole privatization move.
Well, the first thing that they tried to do, and with, I have to say, with some success, is to convince people that the system is in a crisis. The president talked about this quite a bit. It's going bankrupt. And you may recall that at a certain point, he actually went to a federal facility in West Virginia where the Treasury bonds are kept that the Social Security Trust Fund holds. They're in a, as he pointed out, a filing cabinet there. And he seemed to think that this was somehow bad. This was a problem. And it proved how insecure the system was. And, of course, it proved no such thing. As my friend Al Franken likes to say, if the U.S. Treasury bonds held by the trust funds are worthless IOUs, as the Republicans sometimes claim, he's willing to offer anybody who owns U.S. Treasury bonds 10 cents on the dollar for whatever their bonds are worth. Because if they're worthless, he'll take them off your hands. And, of course, nobody ever takes him up on that deal. They're not worthless. They are based on the credit of the United States of America, which has been good for hundreds of years. And the question is, what kinds of solvency issues realistically does the system face? These issues, as I'd say in the book, depend on projections that we're making about decades into the future. In other words, these are all guesses as to what our economy will be doing, levels of growth, how many people will immigrate to the United States at any given time, how long people will live in large cohorts. And nobody knows the answer to that any more than they knew it 40 years ago about what was going to happen now. So these are estimates. And if you make an optimistic or sort of median estimate based on past performance of the U.S. economy, then Social Security is really the least of our problems. Medicare is a much bigger problem for us in terms of its financing. Our deficits are becoming a very big problem. Social Security, when placed against those issues, as I discuss in the book, actually, you know, diminishes to an almost nothing problem that's solved pretty easily by adjustments in the taxes and benefits that could be made gradually over time with really no economic impact at all compared to other issues that we face. So, nevertheless, the president, you know, after, by the way, spending tens of millions of dollars in advertising by his allies in this movement, convinced a fair number of people that there was a problem. And so then the question becomes a political question. How do you address that alleged problem? The Democrats have shown unusual wisdom and unity in dealing with this. They're usually easy to split apart and they make a lot of dumb mistakes, but in this case, they've stuck together. And their response to the president's sort of crying wolf has been, we don't really need to deal with that, and we're not going to until you take privatization off the table, because that is a destructive thing to do. It makes the whatever problems exist worse. So when you take that away, then we'll discuss with you what might or might not need to be done in the coming decades to make sure that Social Security remains solvent over a 75-year timeline, which is what actuaries are supposed to want you to do. You're supposed to be able to say that 75 years hence, we know that it will be solvent. So I think that's a reasonable position to take. You know, when one side wants to come in and sit down and discuss with you how to fix the system, and what they're determined to do is do something that makes it worse, there isn't really that much to talk about. There are certainly things that could be done. Most Americans don't know, for instance, that there is a cap on the Social Security taxes at $90,000 of income annually. When polls are done and people find out about that, they are outraged. I mean, they're very shocked and surprised, and they don't understand why that is. How is that fair? And the answer is, it's not necessarily fair. And that raising the cap on the FICA tax, raising the income cap, is the most popular solution in every poll that's done to dealing with this problem, should we assume that a problem exists. So we're in the funny position where the president, having created a crisis out of nowhere, has risked the possibility that eventually taxes will be raised on the wealthiest Americans because of what he did, which is the opposite of what he was trying to do. And that would be, I think, a lovely irony.
Do you know where that $90,000 cap came from?
Well, this has been in the legislation for a while, and the cap has been raised gradually over time. There's a reasonable question as to whether there should be a cap at all and why there's a cap. You know, we have a system in this country where income is taxed very heavily and wealth isn't at all. But if we're going to tax income, let's tax everybody's income, and let's tax all of their income proportionally. So I think that's the question. It's been in the legislation for a while, and they have raised the cap from time to time, I guess, to reflect inflation. But certainly it makes the Social Security taxation much less progressive than it could be. That's offset by the fact that the benefits are more progressive. So if you are poorer, if you've earned less, your benefits are proportionally higher than the benefits that go to people who earn more. So in a sense, that offsets a little bit the unfairness of the tax regime, but it's, as I said, it is still it's a strange secret that people don't know, because most people don't make anything like $90,000 a year in this country still.
Who is Frank Luntz, and what has been his role in the attempts to privatize Social Security?
Frank Luntz is the mastermind of Republican propaganda. He is a, I don't mind saying, a brilliant man, pollster and wordsmith, I guess you could say, of the Republican Revolution, going back to Newt Gingrich and before. You can see him on TV sometimes. He's a consultant to several news organizations, but he also works for the Republican Party. And it was his polling that convinced the Republicans to stop talking about privatization, stop using that word, because Frank discovered that privatization was a very unpopular word. People would hear that the Republicans wanted to privatize Social Security, and they'd be turned off in droves. They just didn't want to hear about that. And Frank drew up a long memo about this, which I quote heavily in the book, explaining to Republican members of Congress why they shouldn't use the word privatization and why they should start to talk about personal accounts. Because personal accounts and anything, the word personal is a soothing word that people like, and it sounds good, and whereas privatizing sounds bad to them. So Frank has actually gone so far as to fine the members of his staff, as he says in this memo, $50 every time they use the word privatization. If you speak that word in his office, he will demand that you give him $50. And he has admonished the members of Congress on a whole list of issues of how to present these ideas. I mean, he's very cynical. I mean, he will tell members of Congress to run against the establishment in Washington, that this part of what they have to do is, no matter how long they've been in Washington is and how long they've been in power in Washington, is to convince the constituents that they're somehow outside of the Washington power structure and they're running against it. And so a similar level of dishonesty, I think, is found in the way they presented this Social Security plan. He tells them, we're going to talk about strengthening Social Security. We're going to save your Social Security. We're going to make sure it's there for you. Meanwhile, the ideas that they're proposing, the actual plans, would cut the benefits and undermine the financing and put people's future benefits at much greater risk. But that doesn't matter as long as you can find the right words that convince people that you are protecting them. That's Frank's genius.
So a little bit bigger picture here. Do you...
Although I should say it hasn't worked this time quite as well as he might have expected so far.
Do you foresee any changes in Washington in with the 2006 elections on the horizon?
Well, I mean, I would hesitate to predict what will happen in an election a year from now, except to say that it seems to me that the Democrats have yet another brilliant opportunity that they could squander. And I don't know if they will or not. They're showing some signs of taking seriously their responsibility to present some kind of real alternative to the public, and we'll see if they do. What I will say is that the fate of Social Security for the foreseeable future will rest on the outcome of that election. If the Republicans maintain control of both houses in the midterm election, I think there's a very strong chance that they will finally make their move on this issue after that election, during the last 2 years of Bush's term. Once Bush said that this is the top priority of my second term, I take him at his word. I think he is a very determined person who is often underestimated by the press, or has been in the past, and in terms of just how stubborn and dogged and determined he is when he says he's going to do something, he wants to do it. And I think to underestimate that, particularly if they maintain control of Congress next year, would be a big mistake.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Mike.
We've just been talking with Joe Connison. He is a writer and author out with the new book, The Raw Deal, How the Bush Republicans Plan to Destroy Social Security and the Legacy of the New Deal.